and remained faithful to the name and memory of Niger. The citizens and soldiers, we know not from what cause, were animated with equal fury. Several of the principal officers of Niger, who despaired of, or who disdained, a pardon, had thrown themselves into this last refuge. The fortifications were esteemed impregnable, and in the defense of the place, a celebrated engineer displayed all the mechanic powers known to the ancients. Byzantium, at length, surrendered to famine. The magistrates and soldiers were put to the sword, the walls demolished, the privileges suppressed, and the destined capital of the East subsisted only as an open village, subject to the insulting jurisdiction of Perinthus. The historian Dion, who had admired the flourishing and lamented the desolate state of Byzantium, accused the revenge of Severus for depriving the Roman people of the strongest bulwark against the barbarians of Pontus and Asia. The truth of this observation was but too well justified in the succeeding age, when the Gothic fleets covered the Black Sea and passed through the undefined Bosphorus into the center of the Mediterranean. Both Niger and Albinus were discovered and put to death in their flight from the field of battle. Their fate excited neither surprise nor compassion. They had staked their lives against the chance of empire and suffered what they would have inflicted. Nor did Severus claim the arrogant superiority of suffering his rivals to live in a private station. But his unforgiving temper, stimulated by avarice, indulged a spirit of revenge where there was no room for apprehension. The most considerable of the provincials, who, without any dislike to the fortunate candidate, had obeyed the governor under whose authority they were accidentally placed, were punished by death, exile, and especially by the confiscation of their estates. Many cities of the East were stripped of their ancient honors and obliged to pay into the treasury of Severus 4 times the amount of the sums contributed by them for the service of Niger. Till the final decision of the war, the cruelty of Severus was in some measure restrained by the uncertainty of the event and his pretended reverence for the Senate. The head of Albinus, accompanied with a menacing letter, announced to the Romans that he was resolved to spare none of the adherents of his unfortunate competitors. He was irritated by the just suspicion that he had never possessed the affections of the Senate, and he concealed his old malevolence under the recent discovery of some treasonable correspondences. 35 senators, however, accused of having favored the party of Albinus, he freely pardoned, and by his subsequent behavior endeavored to convince them that he had forgotten, as well as forgiven, their supposed offenses. But at the same time he condemned 41 other senators, whose names history has recorded, their wives, children, and clients attended them in death, and the noblest provincials of Spain and Gaul were involved in the same ruin. Such rigid justice, for so he termed it, was, in the opinion of Severus, the only conduct capable of ensuring peace to the people or stability to the prince, and he condescended slightly to lament that to be mild it was necessary that he should first be cruel. The true interest of an absolute monarch generally coincides with that of his people. Their numbers, their wealth, their order, and their security are the best and only foundations of his real greatness, and were he totally devoid of virtue, prudence might supply its place and would dictate the same rule of conduct. Severus considered the Roman Empire as his property, and had no sooner secured the possession than he bestowed his care on the cultivation and improvement of so valuable an acquisition. Salutary laws, executed with inflexible firmness, soon corrected most of the abuses with which, since the death of Marcus, every part of the government had been infected. In the administration of justice, the judgments of the emperor were characterized by attention, discernment, and impartiality, and whenever he deviated from the strict line of equity, it was generally in favor of the poor and oppressed. not so much indeed from any sense of humanity as from the natural propensity of a despot to humble the pride of greatness and to sink all his subjects to the same common level of absolute dependence. His expensive taste for building, magnificent shows, and above all a constant and liberal distribution of corn and provisions were the surest means of captivating the affection of the Roman people. The misfortunes of civil discord were obliterated. The clam of peace and prosperity was once more experienced in the provinces, and many cities, restored by the munificence of Severus, assumed the title of his colonies, and attested by public monuments their gratitude and felicity. The fame of the Roman arms was revived by that warlike and successful emperor, and he boasted with a just pride that having received the empire oppressed with foreign and domestic wars, he left it established in profound, universal, and honorable peace. Although the wounds of civil war appeared completely healed, its mortal poison still lurked in the vitals of the constitution. Severus possessed a considerable share of vigor and ability, but the daring soul of the first Caesar, or the deep policy of Augustus, were scarcely equal to the task of curbing the insolence of the victorious legions. By gratitude, by misguided policy, by seeming necessity, Severus was reduced to relax the nerves of discipline. The vanity of his soldiers was flattered with the honor of wearing gold rings. Their ease was indulged in the permission of living with their wives in the idleness of quarters. He increased their pay beyond the example of former times and taught them to expect, and soon to claim, extraordinary donatives on every public occasion of danger or festivity. Elated by success, innovated by luxury, and raised above the level of subjects by their dangerous privileges, they soon became incapable of military fatigue, oppressive to the country, and impatient of a just subordination. Their officers asserted the superiority of rank by a more profuse and elegant luxury. There is still extant a letter of Severus lamenting the licentious stage of the army, and exhorting one of his generals to begin the necessary reformation from the tribunes themselves. Since, as he justly observes, the officer who has forfeited the esteem will never command the obedience of his soldiers. Had the emperor pursued the train of reflection, he would have discovered that the primary cause of this general corruption might be ascribed not indeed to the example, but to the pernicious indulgence, however, of the commander-in-chief. The praetorians who murdered their emperor and sold the empire had received the just punishment of their treason, but the necessary, though dangerous, institution of guards was soon restored on a new model by Severus, and increased to 4 times the ancient number. Formerly, these troops had been recruited in Italy, and as the adjacent provinces gradually imbibed the softer manners of Rome, the levies were extended to Macedonia, Noricum, and Spain. In the room of these elegant troops, better adapted to the pomp of courts than to the uses of war, it was established by Severus that from all the legions of the frontiers, the soldiers most distinguished for strength, valor, and fidelity should be occasionally drafted and promoted as an honor and reward into the more eligible service of the guards. By this new institution, the Italian youth were diverted from the exercise of arms, and the capital was terrified by the strange aspect and manners of a multitude of barbarians. But Severus flattered himself that the legions would consider these chosen praetorians as the representatives of the whole military order, and that the present aid of 50,000 men, superior in arms and appointments to any force that could be brought into the field against them, would forever crush the hopes of rebellion and secure the empire to himself and his posterity. The command of these favored and formidable troops soon became the first office of the empire. As the government degenerated into military despotism, the Praetorian prefect, who in his origin had been a simple captain of the guards, was placed not only at the head of the army, but of the finances, and even of the law. In every department of administration he represented the person and exercised the authority of the emperor. The first prefect who enjoyed and abused this immense power was Plautianus, the favorite minister of Severus. His reign lasted above 10 years, till the marriage of his daughter with the eldest son of the emperor, which seemed to assure his fortune, proved the occasion of his ruin. The animosities of the palace, by irritating the ambition and alarming the fears of Plautianus, threatened to produce a revolution, and obliged the emperor, who still loved him, to consent with reluctance to his death. After the fall of Plautianus, an eminent lawyer, the celebrated Papinian, was appointed to execute the motley office of Praetorian Prefect. Till the reign of Severus, the virtue and even the good sense of the emperors had been distinguished by their zeal or affected reverence for the Senate, and by tender regard to the nice frame of civil policy instituted by Augustus. But the youth of Severus had been trained in the implicit obedience of camps, and his riper years spent in the despotism of military command. His haughty and inflexible spirit could not discover, or would not acknowledge, the advantage of preserving an intermediate power, however imaginary, between the emperor and the army. He disdained to profess himself the servant of an assembly that detested his person and trembled at his frown. He issued his commands where his requests would have proved as effectual, assumed the conduct and style of a sovereign and a conqueror, and exercised without disguise the whole legislative as well as the executive power. The victory over the Senate was easy and inglorious. Every eye and every passion were directed to the supreme magistrate, who possessed the arms and treasure of the state, while the Senate, neither elected by the people, nor guarded by military force, nor animated by public spirit, rested its declining authority on the frail and crumbling basis of ancient opinion. The fine theory of a republic insensibly vanished, and made way for the more natural and substantial feelings of monarchy. As the freedom and honors of Rome were successively communicated to the provinces in which the old government had been either unknown or was remembered with abhorrence, the tradition of republican maxims was gradually obliterated. The Greek historians of the age of the Antonines observe, with a malicious pleasure, that although the sovereign of Rome, in compliance with an obsolete prejudice, abstained from the name of king, he possessed the full measure of regal power. In the reign of Severus, the Senate was filled with polished and eloquent slaves from the eastern provinces, who justified personal flattery by speculative principles of servitude. These new advocates of prerogative were heard with pleasure by the court and with patience by the people when they inculcated the duty of passive obedience and descanted on the inevitable mischiefs of freedom. The lawyers and historians concurred in teaching that the imperial authority was held not by the delegated commission, but by the irrevocable resignation of the Senate, that the emperor was freed from the restraint of civil laws, could command by his arbitrary will the lives and fortunes of his subjects, and might dispose of the empire as of his private patrimony. The most eminent of the civil lawyers, and particularly Papinian, Paulus, and Ulpian, flourished under the house of Severus. Then the Roman jurisprudence, having closely united itself with the system of monarchy, was supposed to have attained its full majority and perfection. The contemporaries of Severus, in the enjoyment of the peace and glory of his reign, forgave the cruelties by which it had been introduced. Posterity, who experienced the fatal effects of his maxims and example, justly considered him as the principal author of the decline of the Roman Empire. Chapter 6. The Death of Severus. tyranny of Caracalla. Usurpation of Macrinus. Follies of Elagabulus. Virtues of Alexander Severus. Licentiousness of the army. General state of the Roman finances. The ascent to greatness, however steep and dangerous, may entertain an active spirit with the consciousness and exercise of its own powers. But the possession of a throne could never yet afford a lasting satisfaction to an ambitious mind. This melancholy truth was felt and acknowledged by Severus. Fortune and merit had, from a humble station, elevated him to the first place among mankind. He had been all things, as he said himself, and all was of little value. Distracted with the care, not of acquiring, but of preserving an empire, oppressed with age and infirmities, careless of fame, and satiated with power, all his prospects of life were closed. The desire of perpetuating the greatness of his family was the only remaining wish of his ambition and paternal tenderness. Like most of the Africans, Severus was passionately addicted to the vain studies of magic and divination, deeply versed in the interpretation of dreams and omens, and perfectly acquainted with the science of judicial astrology, which in almost every age except the present has maintained its dominion over the mind of man. He had lost his first wife while he was governor of the Lyonese Gaul. In the choice of a second, he sought only to connect himself with some favorite of fortune, and as soon as he had discovered that the young lady of Emesa in Syria had a royal nativity, he solicited and obtained her hand. Julia Domna, for that was her name, deserved all that the stars could promise her. She possessed, even in advanced age, the attractions of beauty, and united to a lively imagination a firmness of mind and strength of judgment seldom bestowed on her sex. Her amiable qualities never made any deep impression on the dark and jealous temper of her husband, but in her son's reign she administered the principal affairs of the empire with a prudence that supported his authority, and with a moderation that sometimes corrected his wild extravagances. Julia applied herself to letters and philosophy with some success, and with the most splendid reputation. She was the patroness of every art and the friend of every man of genius. The grateful flattery of the learned has celebrated her virtues, but if we may credit the scandal of ancient history, chastity was very far from being the most conspicuous virtue of the Empress Julia. Two sons, Caracalla and Geta, were the fruit of this marriage, and the destined heirs of the empire. The fond hopes of the father and of the Roman world were soon disappointed by these vain youths, who displayed the indolent security of hereditary princes and a presumption that fortune would supply the place of merit and application. Without any emulation of virtue or talents, they discovered almost from their infancy a fixed and implacable antipathy for each other. Their aversion, confirmed by years and fermented by the arts of their interested favorites, broke out in childish and gradually in more serious competitions, and at length divided the theater, the circus, and the court into two factions actuated by the hopes and fears of their respective leaders. The prudent emperor endeavored by every expedient of advice and authority to allay this growing animosity. The unhappy discord of his sons clouded all his prospects and threatened to overturn a throne raised with so much labor, cemented with so much blood, and guarded with every defense of arms and treasure. With an impartial hand he maintained between them an exact balance of favor, conferred on both the rank of Augustus with the revered name of Antoninus, and for the first time the Roman world beheld three emperors. Yet even this equal conduct served only to inflame the contest, while the fierce Caracalla asserted the right of primogeniture, and the milder Geta courted the affections of the people and the soldiers. In the anguish of a disappointed father, Severus foretold that the weaker of his sons would fall a sacrifice to the stronger, who in his turn would be ruined by his own vices. In these circumstances, the intelligence of a war in Britain and of an invasion of the province by the barbarians of the north was received with pleasure by Severus. Though the vigilance of his lieutenants might have been sufficient to repel the distant enemy, he resolved to embrace the honorable pretext of withdrawing his sons from the luxury of Rome, which innervated their minds and irritated their passions, and of inuring their youth to the toils of war and government. Notwithstanding his advanced age, for he was above 80, and his gout, which obliged him to be carried in a litter, he transported himself in person into that remote island, attended by his two sons, his whole court, and a formidable army. He immediately passed the walls of Hadrian and Antoninus, and entered the enemy's country with a design of completing the long-attempted conquest of Britain. He penetrated to the northern extremity of the island, without meeting an enemy. But the concealed ambuscades of the Caledonians, who hung unseen on the rear and flanks of his army, the coldness of the climate, and the severity of a winter march across the hills and morasses of Scotland, are reported to have cost the Romans above 50,000 men. The Caledonians at length yielded to the powerful and obstinate attack, sued for peace, and surrendered a part of their arms and a large tract of territory. But their apparent submission lasted no longer than the present terror. As soon as the Roman legions had retired, they resumed their hostile independence. Their restless spirit provoked Severus to send a new army into Caledonia, with the most bloody orders not to subdue but to extirpate the natives. They were saved by the death of their haughty enemy. This Caledonian war, neither marked by decisive events nor attended with any important consequences, would ill deserve our attention, but it is supposed, not without a considerable degree of probability, that the invasion of Severus is connected with the most shining period of the British history or fable. Fingal, whose fame, with that of his heroes and bards, has been revived in our language by a recent publication, is said to have commanded the Caledonians, in that memorable juncture, to have eluded the power of Severus and to have obtained a signal victory on the banks of the Carun, in which the son of the king of the world, Caracul, fled from his arms along the fields of his pride. Something of a doubtful mist still hangs over these Highland traditions, nor can it be entirely dispelled by the most ingenious researches of modern criticism. But if we could, with safety, indulge the pleasing supposition that Fingal lived, and that Ossian sung, the striking contrast of the situation and manners of the contending nations might amuse a philosophic mind. The parallel would be little to the advantage of the more civilized people if we compare the unrelenting revenge of Severus with the generous clemency of Fingal, the timid and brutal cruelty of Caracalla with the bravery, the tenderness, the elegant genius of Ossian. The mercenary chiefs who, from motives of fear or interest, served under the imperial standard with the freeborn warriors who started to arms at the voice of the King of Morven. If, in a word, we contemplated the untutored Caledonians glowing with the warm virtues of nature, and the degenerate Romans, polluted with the mean vices of wealth and slavery. The declining health and last illness of Severus inflamed the wild ambition and black passions of Caracalla's soul. Impatient of any delay or division of empire, he attempted more than once to shorten the small remainder of his father's days, and endeavored, but without success, to excite a mutiny among the troops. The old emperor had often censured the misguided lenity of Marcus, who by a single act of justice might have saved the Romans from the tyranny of his worthless son. Placed in the same situation, he experienced how easily the rigor of a judge dissolves away in the tenderness of a parent. He deliberated, he threatened, but he could not punish. And this last and only instance of mercy was more fatal to the empire than a long series of cruelty. The disorder of his mind irritated the pains of his body. He wished impatiently for death and hastened the instant of it by his impatience. He expired at York in the 65th year of his life, and in the 18th of a glorious and successful reign. In his last moments he recommended Concord to his sons, and his sons to the army. The salutary advice never reached the heart or even the understanding of the impetuous youths, but the more obedient troops, mindful of their oath of allegiance and of the authority of their deceased master, resisted the solicitations of Caracalla and proclaimed both brothers emperors of Rome. The new princes soon left the Caledonians in peace, returned to the capital, celebrated their father's funeral with divine honors, and were cheerfully acknowledged as lawful sovereigns by the Senate, the people, and the provinces. Some preeminence of rank seems to have been allowed to the elder brother, but they both administered the empire with equal and independent power. Such a divided form of government would have proved a source of discord between the most affectionate brothers. It was impossible that it could long subsist between two implacable enemies, who neither desired nor could trust a reconciliation. It was visible that one only could reign, and that the other must fall, and each of them, judging of his rival's designs by his own, guarded his life with the most jealous vigilance from the repeated attacks of poison or the sword. Their rapid journey through Gaul and Italy, during which they never ate at the same table or slept in the same house, displayed to the provinces the odious spectacle of fraternal discord. On their arrival at Rome, they immediately divided the vast extent of the imperial palace. No communication was allowed between their apartments. The doors and passages were diligently fortified, and guards posted and relieved with the same strictness as in a besieged place. The emperors met only in public, in the presence of their afflicted mother, and each surrounded by a numerous train of armed followers. Even on these occasions of ceremony, the dissimulation of courts could ill disguise the rancor of their hearts. This latent civil war already distracted the whole government when a scheme was suggested that seemed of mutual benefit to the hostile brothers. It was proposed that since it was impossible to reconcile their minds, they should separate their interest and divide the empire between them. The conditions of the treaty were already drawn with some accuracy. It was agreed that Caracalla, as the elder brother, should remain in possession of Europe and the Western Africa, and that he should relinquish the sovereignty of Asia and Egypt to Geta, who might fix his residence at Alexandria or Antioch, cities little inferior to Rome itself in wealth and greatness, that numerous armies should be constantly encamped on either side of the Thracian Bosporus to guard the frontiers of the rival monarchies, and that the senators of European extraction should acknowledge the sovereign of Rome, while the natives of Asia followed the emperor of the East. The tears of the Empress Julia interrupted the negotiation, the first idea of which had filled every Roman breast with surprise and indignation. The mighty mass of conquest was so intimately united by the hand of time and policy that it required the most forcible violence to rend it asunder. The Romans had reason to dread that the disjointed members would soon be reduced by civil war under the dominion of one master. But if the separation was permanent, the division of the provinces must terminate in the dissolution of an empire whose unity had hitherto remained inviolate. Had the treaty been carried into execution, the sovereign of Europe might soon have been the conqueror of Asia. But Caracalla obtained an easier, though a more guilty, victory. He artfully listened to his mother's entreaties and consented to meet his brother in her apartment on terms of peace and reconciliation. In the midst of their conversation, some centurions who had contrived to conceal themselves rushed with drawn swords upon the unfortunate Geta. His distracted mother strove to protect him in her arms, but in the unavailing struggle, she was wounded in the hand and covered with the blood of her younger son, while she saw the elder animating and assisting the fury of the assassins. As soon as the deed was perpetrated, Caracalla, with hasty steps and horror in his countenance, ran towards the Praetorian camp as his only refuge, and threw himself on the ground before the statues of the tutelar deities. The soldiers attempted to raise and comfort him. In broken and disordered words, he informed them of his imminent danger and fortunate escape, insinuating that he had prevented the designs of his enemy and declared his resolution to live and die with his faithful troops. Gita had been the favorite of the soldiers, but complaint was useless. Revenge was dangerous, and they still reverenced the son of Severus. The discontent died away in idle murmurs, and Caracalla soon convinced them of the justice of his cause by distributing in one lavish donative the accumulated treasures of his father's reign. The real sentiments of the soldiers alone were of importance to his power or safety. Their declaration in his favor commanded the dutiful professions of the Senate. The obsequious assembly was always prepared to ratify the decision of fortune. But as Caracalla wished to assuage the first emotions of public indignation, the name of Gita was mentioned with decency, and he received the funeral honors of a Roman emperor. Posterity, in pity to his misfortune, has cast a veil over his vices. We consider that young prince as the innocent victim of his brother's ambition, without recollecting that he himself wanted power rather than inclination to consummate the same attempts of revenge and murder. The crime went not unpunished. Neither business nor pleasure nor flattery could defend Caracalla from the stings of a guilty conscience, and he confessed in the anguish of a tortured mind that his disordered fancy often beheld the angry forms of his father and his brother rising into life to threaten and upbraid him. The consciousness of his crime should have induced him to convince mankind, by the virtues of his reign, that the bloody deed had been the involuntary effect of fatal necessity. But the repentance of Caracalla only prompted him to remove from the world whatever could remind him of his guilt or recall the memory of his murdered brother. On his return from the Senate to the palace, he found his mother in the company of several noble matrons, weeping over the untimely fate of her younger son. The jealous emperor threatened them with instant death. The sentence was executed against Fadilla, the last remaining daughter of the emperor, Marcus. And even the afflicted Julia was obliged to silence her lamentations, to suppress her sighs, and to receive the assassin with smiles of joy and approbation. It was computed that, under the vague appellation of the friends of Gita, above 20,000 persons of both sexes suffered death. His guards and freedmen, the ministers of his serious business, and the companions of his looser hours, those who by his interest had been promoted to any commands in the army or provinces, with the long connected chain of their dependents, were included in the proscription, which endeavored to reach every one who had maintained the smallest correspondence with Gita, who lamented his death, or who even mentioned his name. Helvius Pertinax, son to the prince of that name, lost his life by an unseasonable witticism. It was a sufficient crime of Thracia Priscus to be descended from a family in which the love of liberty seemed an hereditary quality. The particular causes of calumny and suspicion were at length exhausted, and when a senator was accused of being a secret enemy to the government, the emperor was satisfied with the general proof that he was a man of property and virtue. From this well-grounded principle, he frequently drew the most bloody inferences. The execution of so many innocent citizens was bewailed by the secret tears of their friends and families. The death of Papinian, the Praetorian prefect, was lamented as a public calamity. During the last 7 years of Severus, he had exercised the most important offices of the state, and by his salutary influence, guided the emperor's steps in the paths of justice and moderation. In full assurance of his virtue and abilities, Severus, on his deathbed, had conjured him to watch over the prosperity and union of the imperial family. The honest labours of Papinian served only to inflame the hatred which Caracalla had already conceived against his father's minister. After the murder of Gita, the prefect was commanded to exert the powers of his skill and eloquence in a studied apology for that atrocious deed. The philosophic Seneca had condescended to compose a similar epistle to the Senate in the name of the son and assassin of Agrippina. That it was easier to commit than to justify a parricide was the glorious reply of Papinian, who did not hesitate between the loss of life and that of honor. Such intrepid virtue, which had escaped pure and unsullied from the intrigue courts, the habits of business, and the arts of his profession, reflects more lustre on the memory of Papinian than all his great employments, his numerous writings, and the superior reputation as a lawyer which he has preserved through every age of the Roman jurisprudence. It had hitherto been the peculiar felicity of the Romans, and in the worst of times the consolation, that the virtue of the emperors was active and their vice indolent. Augustus, Trajan, Hadrian, and Marcus visited their extensive dominions in person, and their progress was marked by acts of wisdom and beneficence. The tyranny of Tiberius, Nero, and Domitian, who resided almost constantly at Rome or in the adjacent, was confined to the senatorial and equestrian orders. But Caracalla was the common enemy of mankind. He left Capitol, and he never returned to it, about a year after the murder of Gita. The rest of his reign was spent in the several provinces of the empire, particularly those of the east, and that province was by turns the scene of his rapine and cruelty. The senators, compelled by fear to attend his capricious motions, were obliged to provide daily entertainments at an immense expense, which he abandoned with contempt to his guards, and to erect in every city magnificent palaces and theatres, which he either disdained to visit or ordered immediately thrown down. The most wealthy families, ruined by partial fines and confiscations, and the great body of his subjects oppressed by ingenious and aggravated taxes. In the midst of peace, and upon the slightest provocation, he issued his commands at Alexandria in Egypt for a general massacre. From a secure post in the temple of Serapis, he viewed and directed the slaughter of many thousand citizens, as well as strangers, without distinguishing the number or the crime of the sufferers. Since, as he coolly informed the Senate, all the Alexandrians, those who perished and those who had escaped, were alike guilty. The wise instructions of Severus never made any lasting impression on the mind of his son, who, although not destitute of imagination and eloquence, was equally devoid of judgment and humanity. One dangerous maxim, worthy of a tyrant, was remembered and abused by Caracalla. To secure the affections of the army, and to esteem the rest of his subjects as of little moment. But the liberality of the father had been restrained by prudence, and his indulgence to the troops was tempered with firmness and authority. The careless profusion of the son was the policy of one reign, and the inevitable ruin both of the army and of the empire. The vigor of the soldiers, instead of being confirmed by the severe discipline of camps, melted away in the luxury of cities. The excessive increase of their pay and donatives exhausted the state to enrich the military order, whose modesty in peace and service in war is best secured by an honorable poverty. The demeanor of Caracalla was haughty and full of pride, but with the troops he forgot even the proper dignity of his rank, encouraged their insolent familiarity, and, neglecting the essential duties of a general, affected to imitate the dress and manners of a common soldier. It was impossible that such a character and such conduct as that of Caracalla could inspire either love or esteem, but as long as his vices were beneficial to the armies, he was secure from the danger of rebellion. A secret conspiracy, provoked by his own jealousy, was fatal to the tyrant. The Praetorian Prefecture was divided between two ministers. The military department was entrusted to Adventus, an experienced rather than able soldier, and the civil affairs were transacted by Opilius Macrinus, who by his dexterity in business had raised himself with a fair character to that high office. But his favor varied with the caprice of the emperor, and his life might depend on the slightest suspicion or the most casual circumstance. Malice or fanaticism had suggested to an African deeply skilled in the knowledge of futurity a very dangerous prediction that Macrinus and his son were destined to reign over the empire. The report was soon diffused through the province, and when the man was sent in chains to Rome, he still asserted, in the presence of the prefect of the city, the faith of his prophecy. That magistrate, who had received the most pressing instructions to inform himself of the successors of Caracalla, immediately communicated the examination of the African to the imperial court, which at that time resided in Syria. But notwithstanding the diligence of the public messengers, a friend of Macrinus found means to apprise him of the approaching danger. The emperor received the letters from Rome, and as he was then engaged in the conduct of a chariot race, he delivered them unopened to the Praetorian Prefect, directing him to dispatch the ordinary affairs and to report the more important business that might be contained in them. Macrinus read his fate and resolved to prevent it. He inflamed the discontents of some inferior officers and employed the hand of Martialis, a desperate soldier who had been refused the rank of centurion. The devotion of Caracalla prompted him to make a pilgrimage from Edessa to the celebrated Temple of the Moon at Carrhae. He was attended by a body of cavalry, but having stopped on the road for some necessary occasion, his guards preserved a respectful distance, and Martialis, approaching his person under a presence of duty, stabbed him with a dagger. The bold assassin was instantly killed by a Scythian archer of the imperial guard. Such was the end of a monster whose life disgraced human nature and whose reign accused the patience of the Romans. The grateful soldiers forgot his vices, remembered only his partial liberality, and obliged the Senate to prostitute their own dignity and that of religion by granting him a place among the gods. While he was upon earth, Alexander the Great was the only hero whom this god deemed worthy his admiration. He assumed the name and ensigns of Alexander, formed a Macedonian phalanx of guards, persecuted the disciples of Aristotle, and displayed, with a puerile enthusiasm, the only sentiment by which he discovered any regard for virtue or glory. We can easily conceive that after the Battle of Narva and the conquest of Poland, Charles XII, though he still wanted the more elegant accomplishments of the son of Philip, might boast of having rivaled his valor and magnanimity. But in no one action of his life did Caracalla express the faintest resemblance to the Macedonian hero, except in the murder of a great number of his own and of his father's friends. After the extinction of the House of Severus, the Roman world remained 3 days without a master. The choice of the army, for the authority of a distant and feeble Senate was little regarded, hung in anxious suspense, as no candidate presented himself whose distinguished birth and merit could engage their attachment and unite their suffrages. The decisive weight of the Praetorian Guards elevated the hopes of their prefects, and these powerful ministers began to assert their legal claim to fill the vacancy of the imperial throne. Adventus, however, the senior prefect, conscious of his age and infirmities, of his small reputation and his smaller abilities, resigned the dangerous honor to the crafty ambition of his colleague Macrinus, whose well-dissembled grief removed all suspicion of his being accessory to his master's death. The troops neither loved nor esteemed his character. They cast their eyes around in search of a competitor, and at last yielded with reluctance to his promises of unbounded liberality and indulgence. A short time after his accession, he conferred on his son, Diadumenianus, at the age of only 10 years, the imperial title and the popular name of Antoninus. The beautiful figure of the youth, assisted by an additional donative, for which the ceremony furnished a pretext, might attract, it was hoped, the favour of the army and secure the doubtful throne of Macrinus. The authority of the new sovereign had been ratified by the cheerful submission of the Senate and provinces. They exulted in their unexpected deliverance from a hated tyrant, and it seemed of little consequence to examine into the virtues of the successor of Caracalla. But as soon as the first transports of joy and surprise had subsided, they began to scrutinize the merits of Macrinus with a critical severity, and to arraign the nasty choice of the army. It had hitherto been considered as a fundamental maxim of the Constitution that the emperor must be always chosen in the Senate, and the sovereign power, no longer exercised by the whole body, was always delegated to one of its members. But Macrinus was not a senator. The sudden elevation of the praetorian prefects betrayed the meanness of their origin, and the equestrian order was still in possession of that great office, which commanded with arbitrary sway the lives and fortunes of the Senate. A murmur of indignation was heard that a man whose obscure extraction had never been illustrated by any signal service should dare to invest himself with the purple instead of bestowing it on some distinguished senator, equal in birth and dignity to the splendor of the imperial station. As soon as the character of Macrinus was surveyed by the sharp eye of discontent, some vices and many defects were easily discovered. The choice of his ministers was in many instances justly censured, and the dissatisfied people, with their usual candor, accused at once his indolent tameness and his excessive severity. His rash ambition had climbed a height where it was difficult to stand with firmness and impossible to fall without instant destruction. Trained in the arts of court and the forms of civil business, he trembled in the presence of the fierce and undisciplined multitude over whom he had assumed the command. His military talents were despised, and his personal courage suspected. A whisper that circulated in the camp disclosed the fatal secret of the conspiracy against the late emperor, aggravated the guilt of murder by the baseness of hypocrisy, and heightened contempt by detestation. To alienate the soldiers, and to provoke inevitable ruin, the character of a reformer was only wanting, and such was the peculiar hardship of his fate that Macrinus was compelled to exercise that invidious office. The prodigality of Caracalla had left behind it a long train of ruin and disorder, and if that worthless tyrant had been capable of reflecting on the sure consequences of his own conduct, he would perhaps have enjoyed the dark prospect of the distress and calamities which he bequeathed to his successors. In the management of this necessary reformation, Macrinus proceeded with a cautious prudence which would have restored health and vigor to the Roman army in an easy and almost imperceptible manner. To the soldiers already engaged in the service, he was constrained to leave the dangerous privileges and extravagant pay given by Caracalla. But the new recruits were received on the more moderate, though liberal, establishment of Severus, and gradually formed to modesty and obedience. One fatal error destroyed the salutary effects of this judicious plan. The numerous army, assembled in the east by the late emperor, instead of being immediately dispersed by Macrinus through the several provinces, was suffered to remain united in Syria during the winter that followed his elevation. In the luxurious idleness of their quarters, the troops viewed their strength and numbers, communicated their complaints, and revolved in their minds the advantages of another revolution. The veterans, instead of being flattered by the advantageous distinction, were alarmed by the first steps of the emperor, which they considered as the presage of his future intentions. The recruits, with sullen reluctance, entered on a service whose labors were increased while its rewards were diminished by a covetous and unwarlike sovereign. The murmurs of the army swelled with impunity into seditious clamors, and the partial mutinies betrayed a spirit of discontent and disaffection that waited only for the slightest occasion to break out on every side into a general rebellion. Two minds thus disposed, the occasion soon presented itself. The Empress Julia had experienced all the vicissitudes of fortune. From a humble station she had been raised to greatness, only to taste the superior bitterness of an exalted rank. She was doomed to weep over the death of one of her sons, and over the life of the other. The cruel fate of Caracalla, though her good sense must have long taught her to expect it, awakened the feelings of a mother and of an empress. Notwithstanding the respect civility expressed by the usurper towards the widow of Severus, she descended with a painful struggle into the condition of a subject, and soon withdrew herself by voluntary death from the anxious and humiliating dependence. Julia Maesa, her sister, was ordered to leave the court and Antioch. She retired to Emesa with an immense fortune, the fruit of 20 years' favor, accompanied by her two daughters, Soemius and Mami, each of whom was a widow, and each had an only son. Bersianus, for that was the name of the son of Soemius, was consecrated to the honorable ministry of high priest of the sun. And this holy vocation, embraced either from prudence or superstition, contributed to raise the Syrian youth to the empire of Rome. A numerous body of troops was stationed at Emesa, and as the severe discipline of Macrinus had constrained them to pass the winter encamped, they were eager to revenge the cruelty of such unaccustomed hardships. The soldiers, who resorted in crowds to the Temple of the Sun, beheld with veneration and delight the elegant dress and figure of the young pontiff. They recognized, or they thought that they recognized, the features of Caracalla, whose memory they now adored. The artful Maesa saw and cherished their rising partiality, and readily sacrificing her daughter's reputation to the fortune of her grandson, she insinuated that Bassianus was the natural son of their murdered sovereign. The sums distributed by her emissaries with a lavish hand silenced every objection. Then the profusion sufficiently proved the affinity, or at least the resemblance, of Bassianus with the great original. The young Antoninus, for he had assumed and polluted that respectable name, was declared emperor by the troops of Emesa, asserted his hereditary right, and called aloud on the armies to follow the standard of a young and liberal prince, who had taken up arms to revenge his father's death and the oppression of the military order. While a conspiracy of women and eunuchs was concerted with prudence and conducted with rapid vigor, Macrinus, who by decisive motion might have crushed his infant enemy, floated between the opposite extremes of terror and security, which alike fixed him inactive at Antioch. A spirit of rebellion diffused itself through all the camps and garrisons of Syria. Successive detachments murdered their officers and joined the party of the rebels, and the tardy restitution of military pay and privileges was imputed to the acknowledged weakness of Macrinus. At length he marched out of Antioch to meet the increasing and zealous army of the young pretender. His own troops seemed to take the field with faintness and reluctance, but in the heat of the battle the Praetorian guards, almost by an involuntary impulse, asserted the superiority of their valor and discipline. The rebel ranks were broken, when the mother and grandmother of the Syrian prince, who, according to their eastern custom, had attended the army, threw themselves from their covered chariots, and, by exciting the compassion of the soldiers, endeavored to animate their drooping courage. Antoninus himself, who in the rest of his life never acted like a man, in this important crisis of his fate, approved himself a hero, mounted his horse, and at the head of his rallied troops, charged sword in hand among the thickest of the enemy, while the eunuch Ghanis, whose occupations had been confined to female cares and the soft luxury of Asia, displayed the talents of an able and experienced general. The battle still raged with doubtful violence, and Macrinus might have obtained the victory had he not betrayed his own cause by shameful and precipitate flight. His cowardice served only to protract his life a few days, and to stamp deserved ignominy on his misfortunes. It is scarcely necessary to add that his son Diadumenianus was involved in the same fate. As soon as the stubborn Praetorians could be convinced that they fought for a prince who had basely deserted them, they surrendered to the conqueror. The contending parties of the Roman army, mingling tears of joy and tenderness, united under the banners of the imagined son of Caracalla, and the East acknowledged with pleasure the first emperor of Asiatic extraction. The letters of Macrinus had condescended to inform the Senate of the slight disturbance occasioned by an impostor in Syria, and a decree immediately passed declaring the rebel and his family public enemies, with a promise of pardon, however, to such of his deluded adherents as should merit it by an immediate return to their duty. During the 20 days that elapsed from the declaration of the victory of Antoninus, for in so short an interval was the fate of the Roman world decided, the capital and the provinces, more especially those of the east, were distracted with hopes and fears, agitated with tumult, and stained with a useless effusion of civil blood, since whosoever of the rivals prevailed in Syria must reign over the empire. The specious letters in which the young conqueror announced his victory to the obedient Senate were filled with professions of virtue and moderation. The shining examples of Marcus and Augustus he should ever consider as the great rule of his administration, and he affected to dwell with pride on the striking resemblance of his own age and fortunes with those of Augustus, who in the earliest youth had revenged, by a successful war, the murder of his father. By adopting the style of Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, son of Antoninus and grandson of Severus, he tacitly asserted his hereditary claim to the empire, but by assuming the tribunician and proconsular powers before they had been conferred on him by a decree of the Senate, he offended the delicacy of Roman prejudice. This new and injudicious violation of the Constitution was probably dictated either by the ignorance of his Syrian courtiers or the fierce disdain of his military followers. As the attention of the new emperor was diverted by the most trifling amusements, he wasted many months in his luxurious progress from Syria to Italy, passed at Nicomedia his first winter after his victory, and deferred till the ensuing summer his triumphal entry into the capital. A faithful picture, however, which preceded his arrival and was placed by his immediate order over the altar of victory in the Senate House, conveyed to the Romans the just but unworthy resemblance of his person and manners. He was drawn in his sacerdotal robes of silk and gold, after the loose-flowing fashion of the Medes and Phoenicians. His head was covered with a lofty tiara. His numerous collars and bracelets were adorned with gems of an inestimable value. His eyebrows were tinged with black, and his cheeks painted with an artificial red and white. The grave senators confessed with a sigh that, after having long experienced the stern tyranny of their own countrymen, Rome was at length humbled beneath the effeminate luxury of Oriental despotism. The sun was worshipped at Emesa under the name of Elagabalus, and under the form of a black conical stone which, as it was universally believed, had fallen from heaven on that sacred place. To this protecting deity, Antoninus, not without some reason, ascribed his elevation to the throne. The display of superstitious gratitude was the only serious business of his reign. The triumph of the god of Emesa over all the religions of the earth was the great object of his zeal and vanity, and the appellation of Elagabalus, for he presumed as pontiff and favourite to adopt that sacred name, was dearer to him than all the titles of imperial greatness. In a solemn procession through the streets of Rome, the way was strewed with gold dust. The black stone, set in precious gems, was placed on a chariot, drawn by 6 milk-white horses, richly caparisoned. The pious emperor held the reins, and, supported by his ministers, moved slowly backwards, that he might perpetually enjoy the felicity of the divine presence. In a magnificent temple raised on the Palatine Mount, the sacrifices of the god Elagabalus were celebrated with every circumstance of cost and solemnity. The richest wines, the most extraordinary victims, and the rarest aromatics were profusely consumed on his altar. Around the altar, a chorus of Syrian damsels performed their lascivious dances to the sound of barbarian music, while the gravest personages of the state and army, clothed in long Phoenician tunics, officiated in the meanest functions with affected zeal and secret indignation. To this temple, as to the common center of religious worship, the imperial fanatic attempted to remove the ancilia, the palladium, and all the sacred pledges of the faith of Numa. A crowd of inferior deities attended in various stations the majesty of the god of Emesa. But his court was still imperfect, till a female of distinguished rank was admitted to his bed. Pallas had been first chosen for his consort, but as it was dreaded lest her warlike terrors might affright the soft delicacy of a Syrian deity, the moon, adorned by the Africans under the name of Astarte, was deemed a more suitable companion for the sun. Her image, with the rich offerings of her temple as a marriage portion, was transported with solemn pomp from Carthage to Rome, and the day of these mystic nuptials was a general festival in the capital and throughout the empire. The rational voluptuary adheres with invariable respect to the temperate dictates of nature, and improves the gratifications of sense by social intercourse, endearing connections, and the soft coloring of taste and the imagination. But Elagabalus, I speak of the emperor of that name, corrupted by his youth, his country, and his fortune, abandoned himself to the grossest pleasures with ungoverned fury, and soon found disgust and satiety in the midst of his enjoyments. The inflammatory powers of art were summoned to his aid. The confused multitude of women, of wines, and of dishes, and the studied variety of attitude and sauces served to revive his languid appetites. New terms and new inventions in these sciences, the only ones cultivated and patronized by the monarch, signalized his reign and transmitted his infamy to succeeding times. A capricious prodigality supplied the want of taste and elegance, and while Elagabalus lavished away the treasures of his people in the wildest extravagance, his own voice, and that of his flatterers, applauded a spirit of magnificence unknown to the tameness of his predecessors. To confound the order of seasons and climates, to sport with the passions and prejudices of his subjects, and to subvert every law of nature and decency, were in the number of his most delicious amusements. A long train of concubines and a rapid succession of wives, among whom was a Vestal Virgin, ravished by force from her sacred asylum, were insufficient to satisfy the impotence of his passions. The master of the Roman world affected to copy the dress and manners of the female sex, preferred the distaff to the scepter, and dishonored the principal dignities of the empire by distributing them among his numerous lovers, one of whom was publicly invested with the title and authority of the emperors, or, as he more properly styled himself, of the empress's husband. It may seem probable the vices and follies of Elagabalus have been adorned by fancy and blackened by prejudice. Yet, confining ourselves to the public scenes displayed before the Roman people, and attested by grave and contemporary historians, their inexpressible infamy surpasses that of any other age or country. The license of an Eastern monarch is secluded from the eye of curiosity by the inaccessible walls of his seraglio. The sentiments of honour and gallantry have introduced a refinement of pleasure, a regard for decency, and a respect for the public opinion into the modern courts of Europe. But the corrupt and opulent nobles of Rome gratified every vice that could be collected from the mighty conflux of nations and manners. Secure of impunity, careless of censure, they lived without restraint in the patient and humble society of their slaves and parasites. The emperor, in his turn, viewing every rank of his subjects with the same contemptuous indifference, asserted without control his sovereign privilege of lust and luxury. The most worthless of mankind are not afraid to condemn in others the same disorders which they allow in themselves, and can readily discover some nice difference of age, character, or station to justify the partial distinction. The licentious soldiers who had raised to the throne the dissolute son of Caracalla blushed at their ignominious choice, and turned with disgust from that monster to contemplate with pleasure the opening virtues of his cousin Alexander, the son of Mami. The crafty Misa, sensible that her grandson Elagabulus must inevitably destroy himself by his own vices, had proved another and surer support of her family. Embracing a favorable moment of fondness and devotion, she had persuaded the young emperor to adopt Alexander and to invest him with the title of Caesar, that his own divine occupations might be no longer interrupted by the care of the earth. In the second rank, that amiable prince soon acquired the affections of the public, and excited the tyrant's jealousy, who resolved to terminate the dangerous competition, either by corrupting the manners or by taking away the life of his rival. His arts proved unsuccessful. His vain designs were constantly discovered by his own loquacious folly, and disappointment by those virtuous and faithful servants whom the prudence of Mamia had placed about the person of her son. In a hasty sally of passion, Elagabulus resolved to execute by force what he had been unable to compass by fraud, and by a despotic sentence degraded his cousin from the rank and honors of Caesar. The message was received in the Senate with silence, and in the camp with fury. The Praetorian Guard swore to protect Alexander and to revenge the dishonored majesty of the throne. The tears and promises of the trembling Elagabulus, who only begged them to spare his life and to leave him in the possession of his beloved Hierocles, diverted their just indignation, and they contented themselves with empowering their prefects to watch over the safety of Alexander and the conduct of the emperor. It was impossible that such a reconciliation should last, or that even the mean soul of Elagabulus could hold an empire on such humiliating terms of dependence. He soon attempted, by a dangerous experiment, to try the temper of the soldiers. The report of the death of Alexander, and the natural suspicion that he had been murdered, inflamed their passions into fury, and the tempest of the camp could only be appeased by the presence and authority of the popular youth. Provoked at this new instance of their affection for his cousin and their contempt for his person, the emperor ventured to punish some of the leaders of the mutiny. His unseasonable severity proved instantly fatal to his minions, his mother, and himself. Elagabulus was massacred by the indignant praetorians, his mutilated corpse dragged through the streets of the city, and thrown into the Tiber. His memory was branded with eternal infamy by the Senate, the justice of whose decree has been ratified by posterity. In the room of Elagabulus, his cousin Alexander was raised to the throne by the Praetorian Guards. His relation to the family of Severus, whose name he assumed, was the same as that of his predecessor. His virtue and his danger had already endeared him to the Romans, and the eager liberality of the Senate conferred upon him in one day the various titles and powers of the imperial dignity. But as Alexander was a modest and dutiful youth of only 17 years of age, the reins of government were in the hands of two women, of his mother, Mamia, and of Misa.